Welcome to the Full Tracy Money Under Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It's 7:30 p.m. and that is Salt Lake City time. So I've traveled over here last night. My daughter is competing in a fencing tournament, so back on the West Coast. And what I thought we'd kick off with today, thinking about the big picture, long-term view for various different asset classes, is about agriculture, because this acrimonious dispute that's going on in the Netherlands is just a follow-on from just a large number of public protests that have been going on over the last 12 months. There was a lot of disquiet during the pandemic in Canada when large numbers of truckers also took to the streets in protest to what they viewed as onerous requirements for the pandemic. Well, what's now starting to happen in the Netherlands is that they want to drive farmers off the land in order to try and curtail emissions from farming. So that is obviously something that's going to be a major topic of conversation for one simple reason. We have 8 billion people in the world today. Within the next 30 years, there will be 10 billion. Now, I don't have any doubt in my mind that the world is perfectly capable of supplying food to everybody. The only main reason why that couldn't be the case is because we get in our own way. Now, I remember as a child learning about the subsidies that the EU was providing to agriculture producers right across the EU. There were wine lakes and there were butter mountains. And I remember thinking of this in very graphic terms, and I really couldn't imagine how you could possibly have a butter mountain or a wine lake. I didn't learn until later that those things were held on freighters or held in warehouses. But the reality is that by removing those subsidies, what you in fact then had was a less competitive position for European and North American producers. The entire reason for doing that was to ensure that farmers in poorer countries would have an opportunity to profit from their endeavors. But the reality then was that Brazil became a massive agricultural exporter and basically took most of the market share that Europe and North America gave up. And now we have what's happening in the Netherlands, where there are 3,000 of the largest farmers in the country, or the biggest emitters in the country, are being offered a stark choice. That either they can sell their land to the government, or the government will ensure that they go out of business. And obviously, this is seriously problematic because it pits a very unique demographic against the government, and then it very clearly highlights to anyone with some common sense that one of the reasons why food is affordable is because of the efforts of farmers. Well, I guess there is absolutely no doubt that food regulation in Europe is much more strict than it is in the USA. But there is this illusion as well that food in Europe is clean by any standard. The reality, however, is that the USA has one way of creating seeds, and Europe has another. So America and North America in particular, they tend to go for genetic modification. Whereas in order to get similar results, European seed producers, they use radiation and they bombard seeds with radiation to try and force mutations, and then they iterate on those mutations. In you basically, one way or another, end up with the same result. And this whole idea of Frankenfruit is, as a result, very emotional, but does not actually make a lot of sense. And of course, then there is the real possibility that what you have is this urban-rural divide, where finicky eaters in urban environments think that they know more about producing food than the people who are actually doing it. So there is obviously the potential here that rules will get in the way of the industrial production of food. And the only possible result of that is that food prices will rise. So when we start to think then about inflationary pressures, well, for inflationary pressures to come back down, we're going to have to see some negative downside pressure on housing prices, on wage demand growth, on energy and food. Now, food prices are coming back down. Wheat has continued to extend the decline that began right in the middle of the year, and soybeans have held up somewhat better, and that's at least because China is likely to be a bigger buyer now that some of the onerous COVID restrictions have been reduced. And corn is somewhere in the middle and more or less holding on. But the more important point here is that they are all now trading in contango. And it's not just about the grains. Coffee prices are also now pulling back. And this is a significant breakdown. So, unwinding most of the breakout from the breakout point in 2021, back below the 200-day moving average for Arabica coffee. And then perhaps we can also look at Robusta. And Robusta coffee is very much attuned to what happens in Vietnam, but it got up to test the upper side of the range between 2013, 14, 17, and 21 and failed again. So now, hunting back below the 200-day moving average and testing the 1,000-day. And I think that there's potential for additional downside. So, one thing that we often see in a big economic expansion is that commodity prices and the enthusiasm for a dire forecast for food growth is all is was very similar to what happened in 2007. There was a clear belief that the world would run out of food, that the rising buying power of the global economy and the global consumer would outstrip the ability of the global economy to supply food. And at the same time, there was a huge move into biodiesel, which was basically using foodstuffs to create fuels. Well, then ultimately, what happened was they abandoned a lot of the biodiesel production, particularly from soybeans, and prices for agricultural products came right back down as liquidity was strained out of the market when we went through the credit crisis. But there was an acute fear that there was going to be a really significant bear, really significant dearth of food. Well, unfortunately, we don't get potash Corpus Saskatchewan any longer, but it really accelerated higher in 2007. So we are starting to get some of the same kind of phenomena in terms of the news flow right now, although perhaps not in terms of the accelerated trends that we saw in some of those agricultural products in 2007 and 8. One thing that's very important to highlight is that the Invesco Agriculture ETF, our fund, is now back below the 200-day moving average. The trend is no longer consistent, and it looks increasingly likely that we're going to see lower prices. And this is a futures fund, so prices have to go up fast in order to overcome the downward pressure you get from a contango. And at the moment, prices are not rising, and the contangos are getting wider. So that's going to put downward pressure on this fund. And it is integral to anyone, whoever invests in these futures funds, to pay attention to those contangos, because they do really well in a backwardation environment. And that's exactly what we saw between the middle of 2020 and the middle of 2022. This agriculture fund rose really quite impressively. But now that we are back in a contango, that outperformance is unlikely to be sustained. When we think then about the bigger picture here, we're increasingly going to come up with against these arguments, where you have an urban elite coming up with an answer for the kinds of troubles that they think are very pressing. Or perhaps more accurately, those kinds of troubles that poll well. And at the moment, they're thinking that, particularly in Europe, it's all about climate change. And the big issue with that is that we are going to have to endure significantly lower living standards in order to meet the ambitions of the green movement. Because if we stop producing as much food, the price of food is going to go up and hunger will increase. If we stop building houses because of the intensity of raw materials that they use, well, then rents are going to continue to rise. And if we continue on this route towards electrification, well, it means that there's going to be a lot more demand for electricity. And that also necessitates greater, much greater investment in alternatives. Well, I just don't think it's possible to get to where the ambitions of these climate conferences are pointing without uranium. But uranium prices were down this week and still coming back into the region of the 1,000-day moving average. And this is a very narrow trading band. So there is the potential here that it's going to pull back. I think this is also a measure of what we often see in the markets, that one can have a really compelling argument, but if the price isn't keeping up with that argument, well, then one really does have to reconsider what is relevant or what is relevant to that bullish argument. So when we think about, well, what is relevant, well, it's simple enough. It takes a long time to build nuclear reactors. And then there's a big push into developing small modular reactors, those that can be built in a factory and transported on the back of a truck. And NuScale Power is furthest along in the permitting process, but the share's not rising. So despite the fact that we have these compelling stories, we're not seeing prices advance. So there's got to be another reason. Well, the reason is simple, that central banks have been raising rates aggressively. And when we think about what's going on, well, they're terrified of inflation. And they know that if they don't get in control of inflation now, then they're going to have a much more difficult scenario in future. And we can see that incredible volatility in the yield curve spread right around the end of the 1980s and the end of the 1970s and the beginning of the 1980s. And that was in response to Volcker and raising rates aggressively. And then a lot of volatility in terms of bond pricing. So the yield curve spread is still around negative 76. That was a little bit stronger in here today. And I kind of think about this in terms of three phases. The first is the initial inversion. And at that point, people see that the market wobbles. and people start to worry about inflation. And they also worry about the long lead that the yield curve spread offers, and that it often contributes to inflation, or excuse me, contributes to a recession. Well, then you get the second phase where people start to rejoice at the fact that the Federal Reserve is addressing some of those inflationary pressures. And they don't worry about liquidity getting drained out of the market. Instead, they are rejoicing at the fact that they're finally doing something to control inflation. Then you have the third phase, which is that liquidity conditions tighten up so aggressively that you end up in a recession. And at that point, you get a significant repricing of assets because corporate profits roll over. So at the moment, we're in the second stage. This is the stage where you get liquidity crises. And we've seen plenty of those. So we can think about what happened in the UK pension system as very clearly a liquidity crisis. They contorted their business models to get around the ban on leverage. They basically deployed a leverage strategy to try and boost returns because interest rates were so low that they needed to do something to manage to meet their long-term obligations. So they basically broke the rules on leverage and levered up on their bond positions. Well, then when those bond positions were called, that was a liquidity event, and the Bank of England had to step in and provide serious cash. And it's looking likely that somewhere between 100 and 150 billion will simply have been lost as a result of these margin requirements. Now we can think about what's happening in South Korea. Legoland South Korea has defaulted, and or at least is missing payments, and that's creating a death spiral for a number of companies in that in the general region of that r credit rating. And then we have also seen in South Korea that companies are starting to skip the call on the perpetual bonds. So that means that they're accepting that they're going to have to pay a higher coupon. And that then, of course, for the people who bought the bonds, well, they're not going to get their principal back. So that has the potential to also create a liquidity issue. And of course, I think most people at this stage have become familiar with what's been going on in Bitcoin. And Bitcoin prices have pulled back really very sharply. And Jamie Dimon this week was describing them as pet rocks. But the bankruptcy of FTX has been really phenomenally large, and we're talking about billions of dollars that have been lost, and really nobody has a clear idea of where all that money went. And it's resulted in several of the crypto exchanges going bust. But what that also helps to suggest is that this is also a liquidity event, that if they'd had ready funds available to meet their obligations, they'd probably still be in business. But that's simply not been the case. And then we have what's been happening with Credit Suisse, and they've had to go to the market and ask for more money, basically, by selling additional shares at a discount. So this is a truly global event. And then over the last week, we've had the Blackstone Institutional Retail, BREIT, and SREIT from Starwood have also paused their distributions. So there are so many people asking for their money back that they can't easily give it back to them. So this is an additional liquidity issue. And this is part and parcel of what one would expect in the second phase of a bear market, that initially prices are really steady because people are rejoicing at the fact that inflation has been got under control. But then the tightening of liquidity continues to bite and it starts to weigh on the economy. So we're seeing that an increasingly large number of banks are downgrading their earnings estimates for next year, and some of them in excess of 10, even 15%. So that's one of the reasons why, despite the fact that we have these bullish kinds of stories around nuclear and agriculture, that we're not actually getting bullish action. And the Nasdaq still is pausing below the 12,000 level and hasn't quite yet been able to push up through it. And I continue to think that there is downward pressure here. Particularly the large cap companies like Apple, Microsoft, they haven't yet had the knockdown in terms of their performance. And I do think that Apple is deeply susceptible to additional downside. It's had a significant loss of uptrend consistency. It's had a lengthier range. It's now encountering resistance in the region of the 200-day moving average. Their Project Titan, which is the electric vehicle or autonomous vehicle project, has been put on the long finger out to 2026 now. And I think that there's plenty of scope for that to be lengthened even further. Now let's think about the US dollar. So, some of the big questions are how is the US government going to fund its deficit? The dollar index surged all the way through 2021 and into really the last 6 weeks. And now it's pulled back and done so in really quite a violent manner. So now the big question is how much lower is the dollar going to come? Is it going to completely unwind the big bull market and then ultimately decline down to new lows, potentially even all-time lows? Well, in order for that to happen, what we would definitely need to see would be a problem with debt and a problem with confidence in funding that debt, because there is an interest expense in the region of $550 billion and no real plan for how to contract that. And emergency powers are still in play in the USA, and the Biden administration has not yet abandoned them. So that means expanded Medicare for low-income households. It's not like these aren't beneficial programs, but they are expensive. And ultimately, whenever that necessity from or the emergency powers, which were taken on during the pandemic, are relieved, that's going to start creating issues in the government spending portion of the economy. And as bond availability rises, then it's likely that we're going to see a weaker dollar overall. So with a weaker dollar, then it's likely to be beneficial for commodities of all hues, really, but most particularly gold. So gold prices have jumped in a lockstep manner when compared with the dollar. And the price is now hovering here in the region of $1,800, and it has clearly broken the downtrend from earlier this year. So there is clear recovery potential here, but that also implies that we're going to have a very weak dollar. And gold and commodities do well in that kind of environment, but so do emerging markets. And the MSCI Emerging Markets ETF is firming now and right in the region of the 200-day moving average. And it's looking increasingly likely that the downtrend has been broken. And then we can think about what does that mean in terms of the China versus the rest of the emerging markets question. So it did not fall as much, and it hasn't rallied as much either, and it has not yet broken back above the 200-day moving average. So we're still in a somewhat doubtful scenario right now in terms of iShares ex-China. It also helps to highlight that Chinese companies represent a really significant weighting in those emerging market portfolios. So I think it's very likely that emerging markets are going to start to become much more attractive to international investors as the dollar comes back down, as yields stay somewhat higher for longer. I do think that bond prices have further to come on that bond prices have, our yields, I should say, are much more likely to rebound over the next year. And that's also going to be in response to slower growth. So we have the potential that yields will contract over the next year, even though they bounced in here this week. We're also likely to see that the dollar isn't going to be able to sustain its rebound, and that then is going to create a messy environment because we're still in the second stage of this bear market. We're not yet in the third stage. So taking big positions right now would appear to be rather foolhardy. And one would have to have real conviction in the theme. And I think when we think then about, well, what are the ideas that are doing better right now? Well, it's the kinds of companies that have got a real competitive advantage today. So Novo Nordisk continues to extend its breakout, and this is on the back of its new obesity drug. So people with obesity will want a solution regardless of what else the economy is doing. And I think there was definitely some negative commentary about the fact they just didn't have enough on hand to deal with the quantity of demand. And the trend is still really quite consistent and continues to hold the sequence of higher reaction lows and the series of ranges, one above the last. Then other companies that seek to play catch up with the release of their own obesity drugs are Amgen and Eli Lilly, but they surged over the last 6 weeks and now look liable to unwind their respective short-term oversold conditions. And Eli Lilly has a reasonably similar trajectory and is also susceptible to some additional downside. Now, when we think about the wider biotechnology sector, well, it has popped on the upside over the last few weeks, and it's still holding that breakout, although was in negative territory today, down about 2%. I think we can look at what's happening in some of these very nascent recoveries and begin to lay out what the future holds, rather than focusing entirely upon the impending recession, because there is going to be an impending a recession in the not so distant future. The yield curve spread is about as inverted as it gets, and that suggests that we're going to have an earnings recession. There's going to be problems in the future, and asset prices are going to come downwards. We're already seeing that property prices are coming down quickly. Stock prices have come down, continue to come down, and of course, bond prices really sold off very aggressively this year. So we're already starting to see these issues appearing. And that would suggest that one does not have to be overweight. There are certainly going to be opportunities. We know that the rising cost of healthcare is a chronic condition, and we also know that pharmaceutical companies are very good at treating, not curing, but treating chronic conditions. And the biotech technology sector is the seedbed for really innovative new solutions to some of life's most difficult and indeed costly problems. That does not mean that those share prices have to stay high all the time, and that there is clear potential that we're moving into a less benign economic environment, and that the companies that survive that, those that have got strong cash flows and have the wherewithal to weather a few quarters of negative growth, well, they're going to come out of this crisis in much better shape. Then let's think about the epicenter of risk. And that's, I think, Brookfield Asset Management is a really good example of that. So Renewable Energy Partners is trending downwards. It hasn't quite halved yet, but it's really not that far off it. And then we also know that they hived off the asset management company into a separate business line last week. But the wider trend remains downwards. And I do think that this is completely underappreciated in the wider market, that there has been a massive flood of money flowing into private assets. The hallmark of the sector is that they are illiquid, and that's not about to change. So, because they're illiquid, they don't have mark-to-market requirements. They're only really marked at a new value in the beginning of the year. So, that would suggest that there is going to be some negative surprises in the first quarter. So, these private companies have provided a solution to fixed income or pension investors, which is to guarantee them a solution. And in return, they have accumulated huge resources to put into property and put into private equity. So, Brookfield Asset Management is really about buying commercial properties. And there's a good track record there that they have returned capital, and everyone trusts their ability to continue to do that. But the share is trending downwards and was down again in here this week. And that would suggest to me, at least, that there are problems brewing in what's considered to be the cash machine of the institutional investor sector. So then we can think about a lot of the bullish arguments that have been circulating about oil, that the strategic reserve needs to be refilled. So that's going to require additional new supply. And then we'll have bigger questions about the sustainability of oil prices, because they're coming back below 1,000. The 1,000-day moving average, pulling back below the $80 level. And we know that Russia is a volatile source of supply. OPEC are not particularly eager to increase supply, and the shale providers are very price sensitive. So when prices are coming down, they'll be less inclined to drill. Those are all really quite bullish phenomena. But then we have to think about the bearish arguments, because the price is coming down. So perhaps it's that China's growth is not going to recover as quickly. And perhaps the global economy is slowing down faster than investors really thought possible. So then prices can come down there as well. And I think these are meaningful events, because it's all very symptomatic of the liquidity crises that are emerging and the recession that's inevitable. So single stock ideas can be nibbled at in the near term, and new obesity drugs being brought out by the healthcare sector are significant events, but it doesn't mean that one has to be fully invested. In fact, I would be using significant advances to raise cash, because eventually unemployment is going to rise, and then central banks will act and they'll try to ensure that there's enough liquidity in the market to support employment. And when that happens, I suspect then that stocks will bottom and we'll be back in a new medium-term bull market. But we're not quite there yet. And until we get to that point, I suspect we're going to see much more volatility. And it is worth reminding ourselves that the VIX index has a triangular pattern, and it's now bouncing from the lower side of that pattern. It's holding the sequence of higher reaction lows. And there's obviously still the sequence of lower rally highs. It would seem to be almost a law of nature at this stage that volatility is going to continue to bounce from the 20 area, and potentially that it will break on the upside. We don't generally see significant lows in the stock market until we get a spike in volatility, and that should take us up to around 50 on the VIX index. It's also, I think, rather important to highlight that volatility in bonds has not really come back down and is still very high. You cannot simply have this much volatility in the bond market without it having a significant long-term effect on equity prices, because this is a real panic about inflation and about how rising rates take a dire toll on the value of longer-dated instruments. So, eventually, equity market volatility is going to play catch-up. It'll probably be towards the end of this expansion in bond volatility, but it is going to happen. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I wish all the best to all of you.